All right. Hebrews chapter 9, and we're actually going to start a new section today, verse 15 through 23. We spent 6 weeks in verses 10 through 14 because, like I said, that is the pivotal, I believe, the pivotal passage in Hebrews. It is the summary of everything that goes before and the presentation for everything that comes behind. And in fact, when we read this section today, you might think, well, hasn't he already said that? It seems like a lot of the stuff or several of the things in this section are things that he's already covered before. And yeah, he has. Because now, remember, we built up to 9:14, which is how much more will the blood of Christ purify the conscience? How much more will that happen? And now he says, so because of that, let's summarize. Let me summarize. Let's make these points. So 15 through 23 really is a summary statement of everything that's come before regarding the covenant, regarding mediation, regarding substitution, regarding all of that. Everything in this chapter, you might say, like I said, as we read it together, as I read it, you'll think, wow, I'm pretty sure we covered that already. And yeah, we have. And it's just natural because he starts off this section with a therefore. Therefore is important. The therefore is not just verse 14. I believe the therefore points back to everything from chapter 1:1 through chapter 9:14. And this is he is now driving his point home. Okay. So before we read that, we've got to recognize and go back now and recoup some of the things that he said in chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 9:14. Because I think that's what the therefore points to. Therefore points to everything he's talked about to this point, especially what's happened in chapter 9. But you'll recall as he starts off the book, he starts off with saying, by demonstrating to these Hebrews, to these Jewish readers who are well acquainted with the scripture. That's one thing I think we've got to get understand is that the audience he's writing to are a group of Hebrews, a group of Jewish people who are well acquainted with Old Testament scripture because he uses the Old Testament very well and profoundly to prove the point of the superiority of Jesus, which is exactly what he's trying to do. He's trying to contrast the superiority of Jesus in every way to that of the Old Covenant. That's what he's doing. And he started off with demonstrating the superiority of Jesus to angels. You'll recall, the very first statement that he really begins in his argument, the argumentation is that Jesus is superior to the angels. That's a big deal for them. In the Hebrew mind, it was God, angels, man. That's in the Hebrew mindset. That's kind of the hierarchy of created beings. Well, not created, of beings at all, because God, of course, isn't created. But it was God, angels, man. So when the statement was made for a Hebrew thinking, in Hebrew thinking, Jesus superior to angels, that puts him like higher than any other man that ever existed, because in their mind, no man was ever superior to an angel. It just didn't happen. If you read like the book of Enoch, which it's not inspired. I don't think it's inspired, although Jesus read the book of Enoch. Jude read the book of Enoch. Other really important people read the book of Enoch. We know that because both Jesus and Jude quote the book of Enoch in their teachings, and Jude quotes it in his writing. So it was a significant source, but it was not an inspired source. Someone I was working with years ago tried to suggest to me that they do believe it should be included in the canon, but there are errors in the book of Enoch. I'm sorry, there are errors in the book of Enoch. Enoch claims that the giants that roamed the earth were 4,500 feet tall. No, that's not possible. 4,500 feet would be one-third of the way up Pike's Peak. That's how tall 4,500 feet is, so I don't really believe that's the case. So there are errors in the book, but no, it's not there. It's not, he's not speaking hyperbole. He's actually describing them. It's not describing them in terms of their bigness. It's not like, I told you a million times there are 5,000 feet tall. That's not the kind of hyperbole. He's actually describing them, and he describes them, I think, wrong. So, But anyway, if you read that, you'll see the elevated, lofty position of angels in that book. I mean, that's really the book of Enoch really talks about the elevated and lofty position of angels. I say that not because I like the book of Enoch. I say that because it demonstrates the mindset of a Jew, how lofty angels' positions were. So that's kind of how this group of people would have understood angels. So when the author of Hebrews reports or presents Jesus as superior, that's a big deal. It loses some of its weight for us. It loses some of its impact for us. None of us, when we read chapter 1 about Jesus being superior to angels, had a problem with that. Oh, really? A man superior to angels? Because we all see ourselves as superior to angels. We I think, today see, and whether it's right or whether it's wrong, I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm saying that we don't view angels really as that high and lifted up, where these folks saw. So maybe it loses some of its impact when we read Jesus superior to angels. It was a big deal for these Hebrews to read Jesus superior to angels. It was a big deal, and it's not accidental that he put that one first for that. But then he moves away from Jesus being superior to angels. So he goes to the created order and says Jesus is even more superior than the angels are. And then he moves to Jesus is superior to Moses. Wow. Okay, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. In their minds, there may have been one other man who may have been superior to angels. That would have been Moses. And when you say Jesus even superior to Moses, that's a big deal. That's a big deal for them. So he's challenging their thinking in every way. And then he goes on and says, not only is Jesus superior to Moses, but he's also superior to Aaron. And he goes on beyond that. He says, not only is Jesus superior, but the covenant Jesus mediates is superior to the old covenant. This new covenant is superior to the old covenant. And he walks through that, and he hits chapter 5, and he's starting to go into, I think, where he wants to go in chapter 9. Remember, he hits chapter 5, and he says, I have so much more that I want to tell you about this, but I can't, because this is meat, and you guys are still needing milk. So he spends the next 3 chapters, 5 through 8, giving them some milk and saying, okay, here are some basics again. Let's rehash some of the stuff we've talked about. Let's go over that again. Then he gets to chapter 9, and then the meat comes out. Then he gets the hammer out and says, okay, here's the deal. You and the Jews for centuries have gone through this sacrificing, offering blood of bulls and goats and rams, really to accomplish nothing except for ritual cleansing. That's all it ever did. All it ever did was clean cups and clean vessels and clean. It never perfected the conscience of the worshiper. But Jesus' sacrifice, this is chapter 9, verses 10 through 14. Jesus' sacrifice did more than just cleanse the outside of the cup. Jesus' sacrifice purified the conscience. And so that's all built up to this therefore. That's all the building up to this therefore. So as we read this therefore and read this section, we need to read it in the mindset of all that's come before. And that was a 10-minute summary of 2.5 years worth of work on Thursday morning. So I don't know how long you've been recording this. I don't know if we started. So if you want to go back, if you just came and you want to go back and catch up on some of that stuff, it's online somewhere. Brian can tell you how to get there. I don't listen to myself unless I absolutely have to, because I don't like my voice. So we scream through that. If there's something that you heard me say, that you think, well, I wonder how he got there, go listen, because I think as we've gone through, we've made a pretty good case for every statement I just made as we've walked through this book. So that's this therefore then is important, and therefore now sets up the rest of the book. I don't think it just sets up the rest of this chapter, but the therefore now sets up the rest of the book, because we've built up to 9:14, which I guess I should read because it's such a significant verse. It says, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God. So the rest of the book is that summary statement, or it's explaining and unpacking the purification of the conscience from dead works to serve the living God. And so he's going to spend a period of time on the purification from dead works. That's what the rest of chapter 9 is about. The rest of chapter 9 is that purification from dead works and how that happened. What needed to happen for that purification to take place. And then as you get chapter 10, 11, 12, 13, it is to serve the living God. As we move away from purifying from dead works, he now moves into serve the living God. He talks about the right relationship that we have with each other because of Christ's suffering once for all. He talks about how that doesn't, because Christ suffered, that doesn't now isolate us. It requires community. It requires us to be together. It's in Hebrews chapter 10 that he talks about how if you've tasted all of these things, you've tasted the grace of God, and you go back to, or you throw that away and say, but I've got to add the law to that. He says in chapter 10, there's no sacrifice for you. There's no sacrifice. Then he says to that people who he said, so you got to get together. You've got to spend time together. You've got to be involved in each other's lives. You've got to not forsake the assembling of yourselves together as the manner of some is. You cannot isolate, but you need to be in community so that you can stir one another up to love and good works. And so and it's not an accident that it's, as soon as he finishes his conversation about stirring one another up for love and good works, he goes to Hebrews chapter 11. What is Hebrews chapter 11? Well, the hall of faith, right? Well, yeah, it's the hall of faith, but really it's the hall of action. You know, I think we in our age of grace or church age mentality and in our effort to remove works from any kind of salvation, and I get that it's not about works. We've made it the hall of faith, but if you look at everything that in chapter 11 is, everything in chapter 11 is somebody who had faith and did something because of it. That is, again, it's from dead works to serve living God. Not one of the people in Hebrews chapter 11 has said they had faith and they, wow, what were spiritual giants. It doesn't say that. Every one of the people, and we've kind of begun this a little bit, every one of the people that's talked about in Hebrews chapter 11 had faith because of faith, or by faith they did something. By faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice. By faith, Enoch walked with God. By faith. Every one of them, by faith, worked to do something. So, and then as you progress, then Hebrews chapter 12 starts off with because of that then, because we're encompassed with so great a cloud of witnesses, because and it doesn't mean that they're all watching. That's not the thing. The idea is because there's so many who've gone before, there are so many. There's this witness of good works because we're encompassed with so great a cloud. We should be running the same kind of a race. Lay aside the sin that easily besets us and strain toward the goal. So that's and it goes on through the rest of the book that way. You will notice, I think, as we finish the book, you'll notice some themes that we've already seen. And it's because he said he's built up to that 9:14, and now he's saying, and so here's what it looks like. Here's what matters here. So if you feel like you've been here for, you know, 2.5 years doing Hebrews, and you're thinking, wow, we're just going over the same stuff over again. Yeah, that's important because this is a constant struggle, and I think it was a significant struggle for Jewish people, who had grown up in the law. We didn't grow up in the law. We didn't grow up when we recognize there's an unintentional sin, we got to go to the temple and offer a sacrifice for that. We didn't grow up that way. We didn't grow up with, you know, counting on the Day of Atonement for some kind of covering for the nation's sins. We didn't grow up that way. They did. That was normal for them. I was reading a little bit, and especially as we got ready to teach Sunday school last week, and for this, the Day of Atonement was a big day in Israel. You know, the high priest would go in, and there was a risk of death for him. Nadab and Abihu went in, and they died when they offered strange fire on the altar. So there was a risk, and there was joy when the high priest exited, having done everything correctly, having offered the right kind of incense thing. And I don't think it had anything to do with his worthiness, unworthiness. That's not the case. Or whether he had unconfessed or unatoned for sin. He always went in the first time with unconfessed or unatoned for sin. He always did. Because that was, he went in for himself first. And if he entered until he sprinkled that blood, you know, seven times on the mercy seat for himself, his sin was not atoned for that year. It just didn't happen. So, but when he came out after having accomplished everything the way that God said it should be accomplished, he did that right. He did that well. And he came out, there was a collective, not only sigh, but there was joy in Israel, especially for the faithful in Israel. There was joy because their sins had been atoned for, but that's what they were looking for. They were looking at that blood of bull and goat that pointed to the future sacrifice, but that's what they, you know, their eggs were in that basket. So there was joy there. And so for someone to come along and suggest, no, that's not what the point is. It's a radical concept for them. So that's why he's spending the time he's spending on this for them. And that's why he again summarizes all this in chapter 9, verses 15 through 23. So there's the introduction to this section. Whew. And this is why it takes me 2.5 years to get through a book, because I want to lay the right foundation and get us on the right thinking, right mindset. So let's read now verses 15 through 23 of, you know, what we'll do, we'll just read through 22, because there's no way we're going to get through all this section this morning. So therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. For where there is a will involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you." The same way he sprinkled with blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Okay, so some of you in your translation had the word covenant instead of the word will, right? For there is a covenant or a testament, right? The word here used for in the Hebrew, the word used that's translated in some translations covenant, in other translations testament. The word is the Greek word that meant a will, like what you say, the last will and testament of Brian Neal. That's what's being talked about. He's not being talked about the idea of Old Testament covenant at this point. He's talking about the promise of inheritance, which goes right in exactly what he had said. And so this is all inheritance kind of language. It's all relationship kind of language. It's receiving the inheritance that's been promised to you by your parent or your progenitor. That's what's in mind here. So the inheritance is not, or the covenant is not necessarily just like the old covenant or the Mosaic covenant or the Abrahamic covenant. That's not necessarily the idea here for covenant. The idea for covenant is the will of, okay? But even in the will of, there's still a point back to what the covenant were. So covenant isn't a bad translation. It just kind of, it doesn't set the idea right in our head. It is a different word than is normally translated covenant. Go ahead, Brian. Verse 16 and verse he says it twice, I think. Yeah. Verse 16 and 17. Those should both be, if you have the word, verse 16, for there where a will is involved, if it says where a covenant or where a testament is involved, think will. That's And so not will like I have a will to do so, not the mind, will, and emotion. That's not the same thing, not a desire to do something or a decision to do something. This will is that legal document, the legal document passing inheritance from one generation to the next. That's what's being talked about when he said that word. That's what the Greek word means. That's what the Greek word means. At least that's what I'm told the Greek word means. I wouldn't consider myself a scholar. He's a diatiki, whatever. So again, he starts off with this point back to, therefore, he's the mediator of a new covenant. He said that before, right? We've heard that before. We've heard numerous times. In fact, chapter 9, we heard that he is the mediator of a new and better covenant. So now he's talking about, he's already demonstrated it's better. Now he's going to talk about it being new. And that really pushes then the idea of understanding from this point on. But before he talks about what the new covenant is, he's got to talk about how the new covenant came to be. So there would be this, whoa, you can't just replace a covenant. You can't just take one covenant and replace it with another. You've got to do something for that covenant to be replaced. And so he's going to talk about how covenants were put into effect and how wills were passed down. And he talks about the importance of death with regard to the institution of an inauguration of a covenant or the passing down of a will. That's what he's talking about. So he spends these seven verses explaining how the old covenant was inaugurated and saying, in basically in effect, and the new covenant was inaugurated in the same way, but with really good blood, not with the blood of bulls and goats and calves, but with the blood of Jesus, who offered himself. And remember, he's already walked through Jesus being the high priest after the order of Melchizedek. He's already walked through all that stuff. That's why, again, when you read this, you can't read this just as Hebrews 9, 15 through 22. You've got to read this as Hebrews 1 through 9, 22. All of the things he said, all of the logic he's built upon, all of the scripture he's come into place, all of that plays a role here. And it all has to be thought back on. You all have to think, okay, so remember when he went into the holy place, the most holy place, he took his own blood. But he didn't go to the most holy place here on earth. He went to the most holy place in heaven. He didn't go as a priest after the order of Aaron. He couldn't. He went to the priest after the order of Melchizedek, which is great for us Gentiles. Again, really good news for us Gentiles. If he would have been a priest after the order of Aaron and got into the earthly holy of holies and offered atonement on that mercy seat, he would have only atoned for Jews, and we would be hopeless. But because he didn't do it there, he did it in the heavenly holy place, and he did it as a representative of God Most High to God Most High for all of mankind, then we all partake in that purification. We all partake in that propitiation as Gentiles as well. Otherwise, the council in Acts 15 would have to say something radically different. If he hadn't been an order of Melchizedek, if he had just gone into the Jewish Holy of Holies and made atonement on that mercy seat, then Acts 15, when they got together to conclude how does a Gentile become part of this, they would have had to say, they got to keep the law. And we wouldn't be having bacon. We wouldn't. It would be a terrible, terrible thing. I can't imagine. Ron would be in big trouble because he mixed blueberries and strawberries already this morning. He'd be in big, big trouble. And a grape. So it'd be a really bad thing. But the good news is he did it. He did it at the Holy of Holies. He did it as a priest representing Melchizedek, or the order of Melchizedek, for all mankind, which is huge for us. So again, as you read this section, you've got to read it with the mindset and the context of everything that's come before. So he is the mediator, and again, so what does that word mediator mean? What does he do? Is he's mediating the covenant? He's the one who is establishing and fulfilling and accomplishing the covenant. That's what the high priest in Israel served as the mediator, the one who stood between man and God at that point. There was only one guy that got to do that. Only one guy, and he really only did it one time a year, one day a year, four times one day, okay? He really only did it one day a year. We throw New Testament concepts onto the Old Testament way of life. And we get this idea that, yeah, we could go to God in prayer and we could be confident he's going to hear us all the time. The Jews really could offer prayer, but as far as approaching God face to face daily, that was not a concept they could do. Their ability to go before God by themselves was really limited by the law itself. There was only one guy who got to approach God in his Holy of Holies. And he did that one day a year. And that was only the high priest. I mean, think of the limited access there. That's why when Jewish authors talk about the wall of partition being broken down, that's when they talk about the veil being ripped in half. That's when they talk about in Hebrews chapter 4, when he talks about, let us therefore boldly come before the throne of grace. For a Jewish mind in first century Israel, that is a big deal. That access to God is an incredible, incredible concept for them. And that happened not because they're great people. It happened not because they perfectly kept the law. I mean, we demonstrated. We walked through and demonstrated their imperfection of keeping the law, how they failed miserably over and over again, not only as people, but as priests. We walked through their high priest and how their high priest failed miserably at even keeping the law. The high priesthood of Israel is a shambles, if you really consider it. So it wasn't their really good job of keeping the law. Remember, when we get to Josiah, King Josiah, they've done such a bad job of keeping the law, they don't even know what it is. When they're renovating the temple because the temple's fallen into disrepair, and they come upon this scroll, they bring it to Josiah and they say, "What is this?" And he says, "I have no idea." So he calls the priests, and the priests look at it and say, "That's the law." So he has it read, and Israel is cut to the heart because they recognize we failed miserably in this. So it wasn't Israel's ability to keep the law really well that accomplished this good mediation. No, all of that is, and this is actually what's going to be said here in this section, all of Israel's blessing was predicated not on their obedience, but on the successful obedience of Christ. That's what happened. So he's now taking their mindset and saying, okay, so you need to rethink this. Because if you as a Jew think that you've gained some kind of standing before God because of being Jewish or because of good, really good law keeping, you're totally mistaken. You're totally mistaken because your really good law keeping accomplished nothing. What accomplished everything was the mediation of Jesus Christ on your behalf. So that's the point that he's going to make here in this first section. I got 5 minutes. So he says, and I think we'll just finish. We'll try to get through verse 15. He's the mediator of a new covenant. What is the new covenant? Okay, that's a good one word. What is the new covenant? Have you ever said new covenant? Have you ever said the word new covenant? You know what it means? They may be cussing. I think it's important that we've talked about it before. We've talked about it before. The first idea of a new covenant is first introduced by Jeremiah, right? When God says to the people, he's taking them in captivity and he's letting them know that I'm not going to throw you off forever, but I'm going to call you back and I'm going to make a new covenant with you. I'm going to make a new covenant. That is where the new covenant idea is introduced. And it is a covenant that is where the law of God is no longer a thing written on tablets, but it's a law written on their hearts. He's going to take away their heart of stone and put in them a heart of flesh. That's all part of the new covenant. New covenant really is a Jewish idea. New covenant continues when Jesus stands up on Passover celebration and says to the disciples, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood." Did you catch something when we read today? Did you hear words that sound a lot like that? You should have. When Moses is inaugurating the old covenant, When Moses is he says this, verse 20, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you." So when Jesus stood up to his disciples and said, "This is the blood of the new covenant," that is parallel language to what Moses said. So what Jesus is saying in that cup is, this new covenant is going to replace that old covenant. This blood is superior to that blood. It's superior to that blood. And so the new covenant is the ability to receive the promise, the ability to receive the inheritance, the ability to really receive the blessing that God had promised back in Exodus. What is the Mosaic covenant all about? You remember? Apparently you don't. But the Mosaic covenant is not about being a people. The Mosaic covenant is not about anything like that. The Mosaic covenant is about blessing. The whole idea of Mosaic covenant is God says to them, remember, this is a reference back to Exodus 25, the reference here. Exodus 25, Moses has gotten the law. He's read the law to the people. The people have said, "All that you've said we will do." They've committed themselves to the covenant. And because of that, then there's going to be this blessing. If it's actually stated well in Deuteronomy, if we ever get there on Sunday mornings, if you remember, you know, how many years ago we went through Deuteronomy in this class, it is, if you do what you said you'll do, and if you do this, Deuteronomy 28, I will bless you when you get up. I'll bless you when you lie down. I'll bless you when you go and when you come out. I will bless everything about you, your crops, your kids, your land. Everything will be blessed. But when you don't, I'm going to throw you off as a people and never have you again. That's not what he says. He never says he's going to throw them off as a people. But he says they're going to be cursed whenever they do. If they go ahead, get in, go up. But he never says to them, "I'm going to throw you off as people," because that's not part of the Mosaic covenant. Mosaic covenant is not a people covenant. Mosaic covenant is a blessing covenant. And so what he's saying here is that because Jesus mediates a new covenant, that really is what established and allowed that blessing, the real blessing, to come to Israel. The internal inheritance comes not because they kept the old covenant. The internal inheritance comes because Jesus fulfilled the law and instituted the new covenant. That's what how the inheritance comes.
And that's what God is satisfied.
Exactly right. That God is only satisfied. God was never satisfied with the law keeping of the old covenant. Never satisfied with that. Never satisfied with bulls and goats. Romans 3 makes it really clear that the reason that God didn't wipe mankind out was because of the blood of Christ. It was because looking forward to, in our economy, in our time economy, looking forward to the sacrifice of Christ, God was forbearing the sins that were committed before he died. That's Romans chapter 3. He basically says, and this isn't Paul, I don't think, but this author basically says the same thing that Paul says in Romans 3, that the reason this internal inheritance came was not because there was successful law keeping on the way to Jesus, but because the Jesus blood, the death, and the covenant that Jesus instituted and mediates accomplished, and this is amazing, it accomplished not only his death forward, but his death all time. His sacrifice is not only a forward-looking sacrifice. His sacrifice is a forward and backward looking sacrifice, which really is what the old covenant, that's what the Day of Atonement did. The Day of Atonement was a backward looking sacrifice. The Day of Atonement accomplished nothing for the next year. The Day of Atonement only took care of last year. That's what the Day of Atonement did. It was a backward looking sacrifice. So it actually, what he's saying here actually kind of fits in the whole idea with Day of Atonement. But he says to them that it is the covenant that Jesus mediates. It's that covenant that he mediates that we've talked about before That is the covenant that says that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. This points back to what he said. Remember, as he's having the discussion about the hardness of heart. Remember, he calls in maybe it's chapter 3 where he calls them today. If you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as those in the wilderness. He talks about how God swore to that generation that because of the hardness of their heart, they would not enter his rest. And he says at that point, the author of Hebrews says that, and he's not talking about land. This is in the Neil paraphrase of that section. He's not talking about land. He's talking about the rest of working from getting, you know, he's talking about that. And basically that whole generation died without getting that. But he says, for those who do get that inheritance, for those who do achieve that, they're not achieving it because they're able to, but they're getting it because of what Jesus does, because of the new covenant that he mediates. That's why he's mediating this covenant, so there can be that internal inheritance. Go ahead, Brian.